and the DJ sets will begin. Find us on Facebook by searching at Dystopia Dreaming, or lock in your advance tickets at dystopiadreaming.eventbrite.com. The dress code is post-apocalyptic. Within the desecrated ruins of antiquated hegemonic systems of thought, the seeds for a future free of subjugation begin to take root.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Hello, everyone. What's going on? Today is Friday, November 20th. I'm Michael Ruffalo.
I'm Elora Bussière-Ladessert. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Hello, everyone. Good evening. It is 5:14 p.m. and time for a full hour of independent campus, local, and international news.
Up first, we have Leo Coelho's report on the future of education. This week's segment is part two of a four-part series looking at the history of online education and how it impacts post-secondary institutions.
We also have Lauren Calge's report on lead up to COP22, the climate change conference in Paris.
Then we have Eva Yuguan-Sanje's interview with CUPE 116 on their response to the AMS boycott of UBC Food Services.
Following that, we have Emily Blake's interview with the organizers of the Vancouver Transgender Day of Remembrance.
But first, some headlines for today. In campus news, UBC surpasses fundraising goal. At the end of UBC's seven-year fundraising campaign, it has raised $1.62 billion. This surpasses the $1.5 billion goal and doubles the number of alumni they planned on reaching. Interim President Martha Piper said of the achievement, quote, "It's clearly a cause for celebration, but the main celebration is one of gratitude. This is not easy for people. There are many deserving causes. For people to step up and believe in a university and believe in the University of British Columbia is quite remarkable." This is the second largest amount raised by a Canadian university. The University of Toronto has currently raised $1.8 billion of the $2 billion goal for their Boundless campaign. This is significant as private funds are accounting for a greater share of university budgets. Dr. Piper has acknowledged that donor fatigue can be a concern and said, quote, "We have to have appropriate uses of the money. The main thing is sustaining people's engagement in the university." 30% of the funds will go towards academics, research, and infrastructure. UBC suspends creative writing professor. UBC creative writing professor Stephen Galloway has been temporarily suspended with pay due to serious allegations against him. No information has been released on the nature of the allegations or number of complaints. Annabelle Lyon, acting co-chair of UBC's creative writing program, said, quote, "We are really conscious of not compromising the process going forward. Due process is owed to everyone." Lyon says the university is working on appointing an investigator and no timeline has been set for the investigation. Gage Averill, dean at the UBC Faculty of Arts, said of the suspension, quote, "We wanted to make sure that students, faculty, and staff understood we were taking measures to open an investigation and do due diligence." He noted that no findings have been made at this time. Avril said that to his knowledge, allegations against Galloway have not been reported to police. Galloway was chairman of the creative writing program and known as the author of The Confabulist and The Cellist of Sarajevo.
Now for some local news. The Stanley Park seawall is closed. Due to wind and wave damage, part of the seawall is closed. The outer wall of the seawall around Vancouver's Stanley Park collapsed on November 15th. The broken sections face west, about 100 meters from seawash rock, and is built on packed rock and sand. According to Howard Norman, the acting director of park operations, quote, "This is one of our original pieces of seawall. There was no rebar involved, so a fairly delicate part of the seawall once this starts to happen." The seawall is closed between 3rd Beach and Lionsgate Bridge while park board staff assess the damage. It's not clear how long the broken section will take to repair. A Vancouver Chrome extension changes terrorist to coward. Two Vancouver web developers created a Google Chrome extension that changes the word terrorist to coward. Marv Lavelle and Peter Siemens developed the extension after the media coverage of the ISIS attack in Paris. Lavelle explained, quote, "We wanted to change the conversation we were seeing in the media and wondered about the power of words, specifically the word terrorist." Flavel has also removed the word terrorist from his own vocabulary. Siemens added, quote, "The greatest implication of the word terrorist is power, the power to incite fear. Switching terrorist with coward made us feel ever so slightly better about the abhorrent stories we were reading when we thought others might feel the same." Siemens said the extension was running in an hour and was posted to Google Chrome Store the day of the Paris attacks. The extension is also posted on GitHub and has been translated to Greek, Chinese, German, Turkish, French, and Portuguese.
In national news, 900 Syrian refugees to arrive in Canada daily. CTV News obtained a government document describing Canada's new initiative, Operation Syrian Refugees. As early as December 1st, up to 900 Syrian refugees will land each day in Toronto and Montreal. The majority of refugees will be coming from camps in Lebanon, Jordan, and Turkey. Syrian refugees will be identified by the United Nations and screened by Canadian officials, the CBSA and CSIS. If they pass further health and security checks, they will immediately become permanent residents. According to the document, taxpayers will be paying plenty of overtime to federal government employees who will have to work over the holidays for this initiative. Indigenous Affairs Minister begins pre-inquiry with families of missing and murdered Indigenous women. The new Minister of Indigenous Affairs, Carolyn Bennett, has begun consultations with the families of missing and murdered Indigenous women. Speaking to journalists, Bennett said, quote, "Our government committed that there will be a national public inquiry. I have committed that we will have to listen to the families first if we're going to get this right." The minister spoke of launching pre-inquiry engagement to make sure that the design and scope of the inquiry will include input from the families as well as civil society organizations. The goal is to ensure that the recommendations coming from the inquiry will be supported by the groups that have been dealing with the issue on a daily basis. Bennett added, quote, "It's not the inquiry that's going to fix this. It will be the actions on the recommendations of the inquiry that will be able to help us stop this terrible tragedy in this country." Bennett said she will be working closely with the Minister of State for the Status of Women, Paddy Hajdu, as well as Justice Minister Jody Wilson-Raybould. According to Minister of Justice, the government needs to address systemic issues that are responsible for high incarceration rates among Indigenous people, and an inquiry is the first step. The Liberals have committed to spending $40 million over 2 years on the examination of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. The scope of the inquiry, however, is yet to be announced. Minister Bennett has said the inquiry will start before next summer.
And finally, in international news, today is the Transgender Day of Remembrance. The Transgender Day of Remembrance is celebrated internationally on November 20th to memorialize those killed due to anti-transgender hatred or prejudice. It originated with the Remembering Our Dead web project and a San Francisco candlelight vigil in 1999 after the murder of Rita Hester on November 28, 1998. Rita Hester's murder has yet to be solved. Not every murder honored on the Day of Remembrance is transgender. Some are a victim of violence due to transphobia. In Vancouver, a march is taking place at 6 p.m. at the Vancouver Art Gallery on Robson Street. This is where the first Day of Remembrance in Canada took place in 2001. This will be followed by a vigil at SFU Harbour Centre on 515 West Hastings Room, 1700 at 7 p.m. Myanmar's democratic elections mark a symbolic turning point. Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi's landslide victory on November 8th has been celebrated as a triumph for democracy in Myanmar. After considerable excitement surrounding her historic win, the opposition leader's next steps are being closely watched by the international community. Despite her victory, she faces an uphill battle with the dominant rule of the country's armed forces. If she pushes against the wishes of the military, her rebellion over the last few years will be removed. Suu Kyi will control the legislature, but the military holds a quarter of unelected seats in parliament, meaning it can block any major changes to the constitution. Today, Suu Kyi met with former General Shwe Man to discuss the transitional government. The National League for Democracy released a number of shared goals from this meeting, including national reconciliation and peace. Concerns stem from the 1990 national elections, where the National League for Democracy's landslide win was ignored by the ruling military, confining Suu Kyi to house arrest.
Those are your campus, local, national, and international headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments.
You maniacs! You blew it up! God damn! Santa?
Oh! Nothing like the salt air! Now, if you excuse me, I have a concert to attend.
On December 5th, Mint Records will be hosting this year's ridiculously early Xmas party at the Astoria with performances by Rennie Wilson, Mono Myth, Fake Tears, Energy Slime, Supermoon, Uptights, and a Faith Healer solo set. CITR Femme Concept DJs will be playing the hits all night long, and yes, there will be presents for the first 50 people. Visit mintrex.com for more details. Remember, it's this December 5th at the Astoria.
Are you hosting an event on campus? We are UBC's Emergency Medical Aid Team, a UBC peer programs, and we provide free first aid coverage for events organized through UBC clubs and organizations. We cover events such as Storm the Wall, Day of the Longboat, and Residence Life events. We also offer tailored workshops about a variety of first aid and safety topics to the UBC community. If you would like to request coverage for any of your events, find us at students.ubc.ca. If you would like to request workshops, please email us at emat.coordinator@ubc.ca to get in contact with our team.
All right, welcome back to News 101. You're either listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca. We're broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, and thank you for listening with us.
Up next, News 101 correspondent Leo Coelho's report on the future of education. This week's segment is part two of a four-part series.
Second episode of The Future of Higher Education. Last week, we gave an introduction about the history of online education and the challenges ahead today. If you've missed the episode, make sure you catch our News 101 podcast. This week, we will discuss if online education can foster critical thinking. To discuss the topic, we have an interview with Diego Anticona. He is an interesting character born and raised in Peru. He is a communication student at Simon Fraser University who moved to Vancouver 6 years ago. He is currently working on developing progressive media and internet policies in Canada and in China. He is also one of the founding members of FightForEducationsFutures.com, a space dedicated to discuss intensively where higher education is headed. News 101 spoke with Diego about how the website experience is going so far. This is what he had to say.
Finished week one, we're actually entering on week two. On the second discussion question. On the first discussion question, we definitely got some really good responses from several students and people, expert also on the subject as well, too, that got into the discussion a little bit later in the week. And we got some pretty good feedback, a lot of it constructive as well, too. We realized that the point of our discussion here is to inform people, to communicate what we believe it's a threat to the continuation of higher education, to the enabling of critical thinking, the enabling of debate in a mediated environment, right? So what we believe MOOCs do is, unfortunately, just creates a clique society, right? Like we were talking to Professor Harazim, and she was mentioning as well, too, that MOOCs are definitely getting more potential, they're covering a lot of ground into what is for-profit education, and some of our research as well, too, has actually found that a lot of the data that comes from MOOCs are not coming from independent or not affiliated to any form of higher education or for-profit business. It's actually coming from Coursera, it's coming from MIT, it's coming from Harvard as well, too. So they definitely want to show that they have some form of potential to sustain MOOCs. What we think, though, is that MOOCs, unfortunately, work as a medium to just deliver the information to the student or to whoever is taking the course, and not really enabling them into creating a form of debate or collaborating with one another and building knowledge between one another. Unfortunately, that's not happening with MOOCs. What the advocates of MOOCs are saying is they want to replace universities with MOOCs, and they want to, probably in the near future, the next 5, 10, or 20 years, they want to reduce the number of universities to, you know, just a handful or a few. This definitely creates some issues into what we need to assess. Like, it will create, what will happen to the role of professors, researchers? Where is the funding going to go? If people are seeing that there is not that much funding going into research or becoming an academic, there's going to be a deficit of people that can enable and mediate and research about this topics. Some of the questions and some of the responses that we got from our week one was that, well, it definitely works in certain media, in certain fields, like, you know, computer science, medicine, and a lot of this usually on the applied science, that it's where it works, that is the right answer and the wrong answer. There isn't something, a medium, but there isn't a gray area. But in humanities, in political science, in criminology, in psychology, in all of these other fields, definitely plays a key role. And humanity is not just about the right or the wrong answer. It's not about just technological advances. It's about the whole spectrum of what makes up humanity, what makes up a society. We're not just all engineers, we're not just all politicians, we're not all just psychologists, we're a compilation of everything.
I also asked what is the whole point behind the website and if he could answer the questions his team is proposing.
The whole point of this discussion, either question number 1, 2, and 3, it's to allow students and allow people that are interested in this topic to engage with us and to share their thoughts, to be able for all of us to construct a model or construct a framework that would allow us to have critical thinking and collaboration in higher education. What we want to fight against is the monetization of students, like, rather than just saying, yes, this is right, no, this is wrong, yes, this is right, no, this is wrong. We want to be able to create the form of engaging with people that they can critique and just critique about what's happening around them, not just accepting what's given to them. So that's pretty much what we're trying to do. And question number one was just about that, was just to get all this idea. So it's like this part where everyone collaborates and everyone engages, so we can actually create a collaborative framework.
So you're saying that online education can foster critical thinking? Is that what you're telling
me? Of course it can. There's different platforms, of course. Oh, yeah. I mean, there's different methods of teaching online.
But yeah,
online.
But you're saying that the MOOCs can do that. But online education, okay, it's not just MOOCs. MOOCs are one form of online education that it's becoming popular, that use a lot of feature lectures, but online education as well has been around. BC has been using online education for 20 years. So and MOOCs, they've been using MOOCs for like 3 years.
Yeah. So there is the online education.
Yeah.
When it's mediated by a professor and by TAs, that's fine, because they allow us to actually engage and they mediate between students. They grade your papers as well, too, and they're able to give you feedback in real time and maybe give that human perspective about their research, from their because they're subject experts in that specific area. MOOCs are not that. MOOCs are own their work in an online platform, but they are AI mediated, and that is the whole problem with this. Like, we don't say that MOOCs are bad because they're online. No, we say MOOCs are bad because they are not mediated by someone that is an expert in this subject. They are mediated by artificial intelligence, and unfortunately, that does not foster critical thinking in any form or shape. Online education is very different than MOOCs.
Finally, he shares his expectations for the discussions he's promoting.
What we want to do is, in this part of the discussion, it's a little bit longer because we want to weave everything together from every person that is interacting in this discussion and allow us to create something more concrete as of what would be the ideal way that we can actually have an online education platform that can foster collaboration, can foster critical thinking, and also adapt to different fields, while actually giving the opportunity for professors and for researchers to be able to do their job. Because without them, there is no way of advancing.
That's our segment for today. Next week, we're going to have an interview with Tony Bates, who is a reference in the field of online education, worked several years for UBC. You don't want to miss that. In the background, you heard DJ Premier with the album Beats That Collected Dust, Volume 1. For News 101, I'm Leonardo.
That was great. Thank you for that segment, Leo. Now we have News 101 correspondent Lauren Kalger's report on the lead up to COP21, which is the climate change conference in Paris.
ERUs, GHGs, IPCC. Okay, the United Nations loves its acronyms. But this November 30th to December 11th in Paris, France, an estimated 40,000 people or more, including government leaders, UN agencies, and international NGOs, will gather to decide on a new international framework agreement on climate change. So this is known as COP21, and you've probably heard this term floating around these days. So it stands for the 21st session of the Conference of the Parties to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, the UNFCCC. Now, the parties are the heads of state, and they've been meeting for the last two decades, yes, two decades, in order to figure out how to curb greenhouse gas emissions. Greenhouse gases, or GHGs, are emissions of carbon dioxide, methane, PFCs, and the like that cause global warming.
Despite the noise about uncertainty in the political arena,
warming will actually save lives, not endanger them.
Do I believe scientists? No!
The fundamentals of climate change have been understood by scientists for decades.
Thanks, Bill Nye. So, you heard it. Anthropogenic climate change is here. There's absolutely no disputing it anymore. But what's different about this negotiation, COP21? Well, COP21 has learned from past failures. You may remember such failures as Copenhagen, known as Hopenhagen. And in that case, well, we didn't get very far. Namely, the US and China were not on board.
You suck!
So, this time, priority is on full participation. So, as I said, the two major emitters, the US and China, are now finally engaged. Now, the central idea behind this new and improved COP is escalating targets. It's like when your teacher gets you to hand in five mini-assignments over the course of the entire semester, instead of just one major final paper at the end. You're more likely to succeed at a huge goal when the steps are incremental and clear. So this time around, nations have been submitting individually determined contributions in advance. These are called INDCs, and they've been coming in since March of this year. Because the UNFCCC holds up the principle of common but differentiated responsibilities, these contributions vary. So in developed countries, like us, contributions are mitigation efforts to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. In less developed countries and small island states that are already suffering from the effects of climate disruption, contributions are adaptation plans.
As big players like the EU set bold mitigation targets, other nations are pressured to ramp up their own efforts. These initial targets are for the years 2025 or 2030, so pretty soon. And importantly, these targets will not keep warming within the 2-degree goal. Well, actually, the point is that nations are expected to raise targets more aggressively for the next time phase and so on until 2050, 2100, and beyond in order to reach this overarching agreed-on 2-degree warming goal. So the mechanism of legal force that will uphold these targets internationally is the central goal of the Paris negotiations. Next time, from the Climate Desk, find out why addressing inequality is going to be key to COP21 success.
Thank you, Lauren. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments right here on News 101.
How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's non-profit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union Building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
LA-based rock trio LA Witch returns to Vancouver to play Thursday, December 10th at the Cobalt with special guests Feels and Eric Campbell in the Dirt. Doors open at 8, the show starts at 9:30, and the show is 19+. Find your information and tickets on sale now at timberconcerts.com or in real life at Red Cat and Zulu Records.
And we're back. Now we have News 101 correspondent Eva Uguensinge's interview with CUPE 116 on their response to the AMS boycott of UBC Food Services.
News 101 aired an interview with AMS President Aaron Bailey about the boycott against UBC Food Services. The boycott is intended to pressure the university over proposed increases in international tuition. I spoke with Colleen Garby, the president of CUPE 116, which is the union that represents almost 2,000 staff at UBC, including many at Food Services. She was concerned about the impact the boycott could have on the staff at Food Services. What's CUPE's position on the AMS proposed motion to boycott UBC Food and Dining Services as a measure of protest against the tuition hikes?
Well, we're totally opposed to it, and we're quite disillusioned or upset about it coming forward without even any consultation with the union at all. We think it's not very well thought out. There's over 200 students that work in UBC Food Services. Food Services unionized organization that provides a service, nonprofit service to the university. And we have over 400 of our members that work there, not only the 200 students, but 400 of our members. And they're nonprofit, so they don't make a lot of money. They don't, right. They can't lose it.
Yeah, can you just explain what you mean by nonprofit?
Well, they provide a service on campus for the community, a lot of students and meal plans and stuff. If they start losing money, then they close operations or they shut down services. And so we're very concerned about, you know, what kind of impact this boycott, although we have no idea, you know, what kind of impact it will have, but we are concerned that if it is an impact, then our members are going to start losing hours.
Mm-hmm.
Students are going to start losing hours, and we don't think it's going to be effective or beneficial. And we totally understand the plight of keeping tuition down and protesting against the tuition hikes, and this university seems to be only for the rich. But we think there's a better way of going about it, and we think that we should have been consulted.
So have you had any communication then with the AMS as of now?
We met with them Tuesday. Some of them seem generally concerned about our concerns. They hadn't really thought it out, what the ramifications of this would be. And the others were, well, look, there's a motion that's happened, and it's in place, and it's going to be a three-week boycott,
which is the first we heard
that it was just going to be a three-week boycott, and that it has to go forward because you can't undo a motion unless you go to an executive meeting, and that's just not going to happen until the end of November. But we were quite taken aback that they would initiate this kind of an action without talking to us, particularly when we do talk to the AMS. I mean, we do bargain.
So would your position be that then any boycott would be opposed by QP, or is
any boycott that affects our membership and their ability to work and earn money, earn their living, for sure. I mean, we've always advocated on behalf of students. We're here to support wherever we can and help them, and, you know, if they communicate, something that we can do.
All right, that was wonderful. Thank you for that interview, Eva.
For our last story of the evening, we have News 101 director Emily Blake's interview with the organizers of the Vancouver Transgender Day of Remembrance. The march starts today at 6 p.m. from the Vancouver Art Gallery on Robson Street.
People that don't know, what is the Transgender Day of Remembrance?
The Transgender Day of Remembrance was struck by our good friend Gwen Smith in San Francisco, because her good friend was murdered, and there didn't seem to be anything being done about it, so she decided to rally her community and memorialize her, and then found out that there was a lot more trans people who were murdered, and decided to make it a full-fledged vigil march.
Why is this day so important?
It brings attention to the community as a whole, wherever it may be, that there is a lot of violence and oppression to trans people locally and globally. And that violence can include a lack of workplace rights, the lack of healthcare access to different types of violence, and of course oppression, yes, a myriad.
And what can cisgender people do to be better allies to the trans community?
Get to know some trans people, organize, take the lead. I mean, not take the lead, but take the lead from trans people about what their needs are. Ask them what they need.
And can you tell me a bit about this year's event in Vancouver?
This year's event is Friday, November the 20th, which is the actual date that most locations commemorate. We're meeting at the Vancouver Art Gallery, the Robson side, at 6 o'clock p.m., Friday, November the 20th, and we will march towards SFU Harbor Center, which is at 515 West Hastings. And room 1700 is where we'll have the vigil and read out the names of trans people and how they were murdered, if there is a criminal case pending or not. It will be ASL interpreted.
We also have tactile interpreters and intervenors for the deaf-blind folks. If they wish to contact us, we'll arrange that.
So how did you get involved in this year's event?
Well, I'm the founder of the event, so I've been actually organizing this for 14 years. And this is the 14th year in Canada, and this is the first Vancouver Transgender Day of Remembrance is the first in Canada.
Yeah, could you tell me a bit more about the first time you organized it?
Oh, sure. By the seat of my pants, I was connecting with people in the U.S. who had already been in their third year of organizing it, and specifically Gwen Smith, who's the founder of the Remembering Our Dead Project in out of San Francisco, her and another friend in Houston, Texas, who are trans organizers in America, basically inspired me to get off my butt and help organize an event for the community in Vancouver. And we, and I basically had a call out to the community. The community responded. We formed a committee, and we organized our first ever one at the end of 2001, of course, November the 20th. And it was well attended. We probably had 80 people there, maybe close to 100. I was shocked at the turnout. It was well attended and well organized. We rallied in front of the center, which is now called Community, on Butte and Davie, and we marched down Davie Street to the Vancouver Art Gallery. So this year we're kind of commemorating that we rallied to the Vancouver Art Gallery. This time we're rallying at the Art Gallery in the exact same spot 14 years later and marching down to Harbor Center.
And what have you seen change since you started the rally?
The community has gotten a great deal of visibility. Definitely the community is more organized. There is a lot of room for improvement. However, I'm very encouraged by the past decade of actions in the community. There's the Trans March that coincides around Pride Week in Vancouver. And various things like the gendered washrooms at SFU, making them gender neutral, and having conversations in the community, as well as various other happenings that have happened that have included, and where there was a lot of discussion about the gender binary and gender inclusion and how trans people can have access to healthcare and basic rights and privileges that everybody else is experiencing.
What do you think is still misunderstood or changes you'd like to see?
I believe that there is still quite the stratification of gender in the binary that happens an awful lot. I, for all intents and purposes, I grew up in quite a white sort of household because of colonization. My mother's actually from the reserve in Manitoba, and so I wasn't really privy to different sexualities and gender identities and even abilities growing up. And through my community organizing, Trans Day of Remembrance being one of them, I really learned a lot about how diverse communities actually are and how to engage with diverse communities in a pretty healthy, robust way. And I feel I'm beyond grateful for that lived experience. And I feel that as communities, we really need to hopefully get farther away from gendered policing spaces that harm people and be more dynamic with how we hold our communities accountable and organize and be together as communities.
In terms of changes, I'll also add something as simple as the changing of government and municipal forms to add some sort of gender accessibility on that. I'm a non-binary identified variant individual, and when I'm running into, work with government or municipal government, provincial, whatever, there's this huge box that you have to tick. Are you a man? Are you a woman? I identify as neither, and there's a lot, there needs to be a change in the accessibility there for people who are identifying in a different way.
There's currently a court case before the province of British Columbia to remove the gender marker in birth certificates. I think that it's important for, once again, our communities, wherever they may be, to understand that gender binary enforcement has caused a lot of problems in society and is becoming more and more obvious as more and more people become aware that there are more options available to them than simple, narrowly constructed binaries. The interesting thing about that is that Indigenous communities have long understood this reality with two-spirited or multi-spirited people.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me.
For sure. Thanks for talking with me.
And we're back. Thank you, Emily. All right, that's it. That's our program for today, November 20th. I'd like to let everyone know that today's newscast was brought to you by volunteer efforts. And if you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. Or you can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/radio/news-101. For more independent news, join us next Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Michael Ruffalo.
And I'm Elora Bussière-Ladouceur. Today's broadcast was produced by News 101 director Rohit Joseph. From the entire news team at CITR, thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Lady Radio from the Women's Collective right here on CITR 101.9 FM. To close the show, we have Repetition by Other Jesus from their LP Everything is Problematic, now number 20 on CITR's charts.